Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Kostura.
Hello everyone.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of July 29th, 2024. So I wanted to start with kind of an unusual topic for me, but it's just a Bleeping Computer article, Tom, and it was titled, Acronis Warns of Cyber Infrastructure Default Password Abused in Attacks. And so Acronis Cyber Infrastructure, ACI, is a unified multi-tenant platform that offers cyber protection that really combines remote endpoint management, backups, virtualization capabilities, and it's really designed to run disaster recovery workloads and store enterprise backup in a secure manner. So pretty critical piece of infrastructure as far as reliability goes, right? And they obviously had this vulnerability that allows remote code execution by using somehow enabling or allowing you to use the default credentials to do so. And I read this and kind of thought to myself, like, man, if I had this tool, I feel like I would have deployed it in a manner where this wouldn't be as impactful, but yet still something I would still want to address. But I wouldn't be like, but I feel like people read this and the way it's presented is like the world's on fire. We got to just jump to everything all of a sudden. And it kind of got me thinking about the concept of, you know, boundaries, that whole zero trust, the, you know, where do we segment things? And it's interesting because this involves creds. So I remember a long time back that people were saying boundaries are broken because the cloud exists, right? Like there's no borders anymore. There's no that filtering. Everything is kind of managed based on credentials and authentication almost to say what's allowed to talk to what, which is interesting only because people say passwords are one of the weakest measures when it comes to security, depending on what forum you're kind of talking in. And there's ways that make that more robust, but you know, that's a common perception. And then it kind of came back to like, you know, this is a good example where if you're running this type of stuff, even if someone was able to run or do remote code execution with a default password, I imagine you should still be coming from a special place of origin in order to interact with any kind of management or any kind of open exposed communication ports on this type of infrastructure device. Now, I don't know what the deployment for this looks like, so maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but I always think that's how people should maybe be thinking about these types of problems ahead of time, right? So, you know, it really comes down to what is the role of whatever solutions and things that we're running? What is that criticality? And what are the different ways that we can scale or scope interaction in general? I mean, it's kind of like the zero trust model, except for zero trust is kind of like you're supposed to like not trust anything, you know, with some exceptions based on deployments. But I feel like this problem wouldn't be that big of a deal if you're following some guidelines of best practices, not just, hey, we have this solution up and look what it offers, versus thinking about what could the overall impact be? Because it sounds like if this goes down, or this is able to interact with your environment or do things within your environment, you're in a bad place. And so it just kind of, I wanted to like surface, I guess, that conversation. I didn't know if you had any similar ideas, Tom, or, you know, your head went to in any of the similar places mine went when it came to this being a glaring, you know, big problem, and like really thinking about the problem in the context of how it really should be, I guess, managed or viewed.
Yeah, I mean, this really threw a lot of similar thoughts into my head when I was reading through this article. You know, some emphasis to like all the points that you had just made. You know, I reading the article, it does talk about Acronis having released the patch for this vulnerability 9 months ago. And you have this newer article within the past 7 days talking, you know, demonstrating or talking about this vulnerability being seen having exploitations in the wild, right? So people are still trying to take advantage of this. So that led to literally all the same thoughts that you had of, you know, how are we taking the approach to manage these systems? If they are this critical, what is our framework around handling these? If there is a patch available 9 months ago, I would think since you're seeing this exploited in the wild, there are still a lot of people not patched, or at least some, right? So it's, you know, what are we thinking about here when we're deploying these things, when it's leveraging default creds, like these things, like there was a lot of kind of just, you know, it's almost like taking it back, like, why is this a thing kind of question? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you say exploded in the wild, and the only way I can imagine that kind of visibility to determine that is that there are these types of services publicly exposed, right? Because how would people out in the wild be able to observe the exploitation where they have sensors? Because they don't have sensors within people's environment to usually enumerate that kind of data. So it's just crazy that is the consideration with deployments like this potentially, right? Even if this was a SaaS application or a cloud, you know, deployed type thing where there could be technically access just based on proximity, right? Because you're kind of on the internet, there are still controls where if this is only supposed to interact with your environment in the cloud or on-prem, but it's running in the cloud, that you know where you're coming from on-prem, right? Wherever your data centers are and things, that you could still set up some static routing and network controls to basically limit what is actually communicating and where it can communicate, right? Like I find it wild that solutions like this, just things can beat on it, you know?
Well, posing a question to you, I'm just curious your thoughts, because this is where my head starts to go. And we've seen it even over the last couple of weeks. We've had different parts where we've talked about it, but you know, the vendor deploying a product, with the approach of an ease to use, plug and play, out of the box solution type things. I wonder how much that plays in to the methodology any company would use to leverage a product in this way, and then not consider those things that you and me as security practitioners, we would think would be, you know, just automatic, right? They'd be part of the process. And I just wonder how much, you know, that push to the out of the box solution, ease of use, you know, less hands-on, you know, throw it in air, AI solutions, you know, all these things that you constantly hear and are being pumped. I wonder how much that played into this being this kind of a problem, you know?
Well, so, you know, I think you bring up an interesting point and something that I've been kind of plagued with in numerous conversations when we come across problems in past lives where you're like, why is this way, right? And it's never that people disagree that, oh, we really should be doing it this way. Usually, I think some of those, like, people want that out-of-the-box solution. It's supposed to work this way. And by the way, this way, how it's supposed to work, is usually based on best practices, right? So if you have an organization where the environment maybe isn't deployed with the scope of best practices everywhere, then that standard deployment isn't standard anymore. Because I'm sure you've been in situations where you come across like, hey, why are we doing this? Like, no, we totally agree. We want to do it that way. But because we have everything IP addressed this way, or because we have, you know, these types of boundaries set up, we can't actually manage or get visibility or do these things as expected. And it becomes, well, gosh, what would it take to do that? And be like, well, re-engineering the network or re-engineering whatever. And it becomes such a large scale project for a smaller, simple solution that it just becomes not worth it at that point, right? So then you really rely on, well, as long as we have really good managed credentials and we do things best here, that should accommodate these other problems, maybe, right? That's what's always interesting when it comes to, it's really hard to think ahead, especially with how things change, but it really is worth having the right people at the table when you're planning things, and not just the people that know how technology works, but the people that know how, like, the businesses should function, the people that know what are the best practices across when it comes to compliance and security, like all those same people in the room when it comes to actually implementing a plan for projects to be built and executed, because I think it helps reduce those pitfalls. But I think that's when you run into that, like, here's the easy button for the solution that everyone wants to deploy, and it makes the deployment super simple without getting all those gotchas a lot of times. Because I don't know if you remember back in the day, you would roll out a solution and the default configurations were the least secure. Now I feel like it's kind of a mixed bag, but there's more secure options that don't require like extra steps. Like, for instance, if you want to have HTTPS, you know, encrypted web traffic for some sort of GUI or something like that, you may have to have the extra steps of generating your own certs. So that doesn't come enabled by default, but like other types of security mechanisms within products that don't require those extra steps outside of the product itself usually now come enabled in most cases. So, yeah, it's just an interesting, approach, but you know, I think if everything comes with a consistent approach with, you know, what's the point and purpose of something and just keep it scoped to just that. And if you can dial it in, it really does become easier to manage once you get it working as expected. There might be some pain points in like a little longer term setting things up, but man, once things are actually set up exactly how you want them, then it becomes easier to defend because your expectations are exactly what you see, because you validated everything. You're easier to manage because you know what it's supposed to be doing. And then when things like this vulnerability and thing has come up, you immediately know your risk and your exposure. You're like, well, only risk is if you can get to this point. And if you get to this point, you can get to this, but you can get to many other things. And you'd have to have this level of access to do so. So we're already in a really bad place. So we're not in that bad place today, and we can validate that. So we just need to get this patch to move forward and not, you know, start, you know, turning max resources into a problem that doesn't need that.
Right. Do all the legwork up front.
Yeah. I mean, it's always the case, right? It's hard to do, but there is value.
100%.
So yeah, that was why I brought this one up. I usually don't like talking vulnerabilities because vulnerabilities come and go and they're always going to be there. But it's just one of those things where I was just surprised to see something so exposed that this would be a big deal to some people, right? And yeah, it's just a thing. So just more of a thought piece. I like to think about things more than actually get the technical stuff sometimes.
100%. Very much agree.
So what do you got for us?
So, you know, there's some parallels in the first thing I have. So research report that came out of Guardio Labs, titled "A Massive Phishing Campaign Exploiting Proofpoint's Email Protection to Dispatch Millions of Perfectly Spoofed Emails," dubbed echo spoofing. So this one was really interesting. A lot that I'll tie into later with some of personal experience in the old SOC days of seeing spoofed emails and some that were more clever than others. But Guardio Labs uncovered a critical in the wild exploit of Proofpoint's email protection service, responsible for securing 87 of the Fortune 100 companies. It's dubbed echo spoofing, and the issue allowed threat actors to dispatch millions of perfectly spoofed phishing emails, leveraging Proofpoint's customer base of well-known companies and brands like Disney, IBM, Nike, Best Buy, Coca-Cola, and so on. So the basic overview, the adversary would craft a spoofed email from a virtual private SMTP server in a way that would include specific header information, allowing it to take advantage of a function in Microsoft Exchange that allows the spoofed email to simply be blindly relayed. And now you have a spoofed email that has successfully been relayed through Office 365. So Proofpoint configurations for what, in my opinion, seems to be more of a user-friendly administration and setup thought process here, which I'm going to tie into our previous conversation. It simply has a basic checkbox that allows these emails from hosted services like Office 365 or Google Apps, as examples, with no additional specifics to enter. So it'll allow any, as long as you check that box, if they come from Office 365 or Google Apps, as the examples. So now when your adversary spoofs, the adversary spoofed email is sent, it's relayed through Office 365 and pointed at the Proofpoint host, which is done by the adversary identifying the specific host from the being spoofed true domain's public MX record. So basically they can identify which specific Proofpoint host to point these spoofed emails through from the major companies' public MX records. So Proofpoint will then take that email, pass it through Foley, fully legitimate. Now you have a well-crafted, fully spoofed domain. So this campaign, using this technique, has been occurring since January of 2024. Some of the evidence that they point on the article is some of the staging and account stuff that they had identified was within a couple months before January 2024, so back end of last year. But in 2024, there's been, on average, 3 million spoofed phishing emails sent through this process per day, with peaks hitting somewhere around the 14 million emails sent a day. That was just astounding to me.
Right.
Some other points that kind of come down to this, and we can dive into the nitty gritty, because I want to get your vibe on this too. But Proofpoint did work with Guardio really well on this issue, and I thought that was cool. That was one of the favorable reads of this, how there was a hand-in-hand kind of, hey, we identified this as a problem. Proofpoint says, okay, let's work together on releasing and letting this information out, working with our customers to support it. But they worked heavily with their customers affected to remediate the issue. There are ways within Proofpoint, they're already there, to add manual custom configurations to like allow parameters to consider other pieces of the header data, as example, or add custom scripts for blocking, redirecting, allows, not allows, things like that you can already do in Proofpoint. It's just not immediately visible to somebody that's deploying it. It's more of that, you know, what I was referencing in that what could possibly be with the Acronis issue is just ease of deployment, right? So just get it going, get it up and running, have your company off and going, but there's no consideration for these specific possibilities, right? So I'll take a breath. I said a whole lot there. I thought this was incredibly interesting. I have some other points, but I want to bounce off you first, see what you thought of this.
Yeah, so one of the things I really liked about this was the level of understanding that the adversaries obviously had about email in general compared to the people that were deploying or trying to secure their email services, because it makes sense on both sides why it happened. So just kind of break down a little bit. One of the reasons why the Proofpoint gateway solution was able to basically allow the spoofing is it was part of the it had validations with SPF and DKIM. So what does that mean? So SPF, the sender policy framework, that's as simple as saying in the DNS record that basically says this is where websites are, these are where mail gateways are and stuff like that associated with certain domains. Like, you know, in this case, they use Disney as the example. When email comes into an email server, they can look at that header and say, oh, this says it's from Disney. They can go look at the SPF information in DNS and say, did it come from an IP that's an approved sender, right? So it's that immediate, like, is it an approved sender? Sure, cool. That can validate it. Now, DKIM, on the other hand, it's basically like a signing of the content. Like, you know, think about public and private keys. So basically you can say, hey, all the content that's apparently sent by Disney, for instance, is the content's then signed. So now you know it came from a valid sender and the content was signed by the correct keys. But the Proofpoint isn't the originator, right? It's really just a gateway to like proxy the email through. So you kind of offloaded all that validation from being internal in your environment to like a layer out.
Right.
So now anything that's able to pass something that looks like Disney, in their example, to go through that gateway, now it becomes validated before it even gets to a place of, you know, I guess better validation, right? Or it gets validated early enough in the chain so everything downstream will trust it. And that's what this attacker was able to figure out. Now, on top of that, they did have their own, you know, Microsoft Exchange server, like a local one, right? Where they originated these emails from. And they had to pass it through Office 365 Exchange. And the reason for that is because Office 365 is like a huge distributed, everyone uses 365. There's IP ranges and addresses all over the internet for that. And it was just become trusted because you don't know how things are going to go in and out of the cloud, right? So that was their way to say Proofpoint can't filter that easily just based on IP addresses alone. So there's just an inherent trust that kind of just exists unless you tweak it. And so now you can, as long as you, well, whatever email server you have, you can pass it through 365 and you can have it not alter anything. It now can hit Proofpoint's gateways. It validates everything for you. And now you have this great campaign, right? And it doesn't even have to
it's
go.
It's not going
to
be picked up by anybody's device, right?
Right? There's no control that's going to identify and validate that other than, like, obviously if you have other services that maybe like dig into links and do content-based filtering based on what might be in there, you might pick up on some other things. But on from the standard email metadata and email pieces that usually are there to help validate some of these things, those become completely dismissed. So I thought that was really interesting. And so to me, I remember like SPF and DKIM learning about it, aware, right, that yes, they offer security. Could never really remember exactly how, but I knew that if you can just implement them, they're good. But you know, this is just a good example of if you don't really understand how these technologies work, you can't understand the inherent risks as far as how you deploy them or how you manage them. And obviously, I wouldn't lean and say because we have this in place, we're protected, right? And it's hard to think of every possible scenario where, oh, well, if we implement it like this, this is going to be a problem. I think it's always really good to simplify the technology down to saying, well, this is what we're trying to achieve. And here are, you know, a simple diagram of how things flow and move and what checks are happening in what place and where, right? Like, just be able to, like, if you can boil things down to that simplistic view, to have conversations internally with your team, just so that if anything does come up, you can kind of use it as a point of reference quickly to say, oh, I'm getting questions on this, I can explain this better, whatever it is. I think that's really important because, one, it shows your comprehension of your solution, but also might help identify potential risks, right? It's like a step back approach. Sometimes as like security professionals or technical enthusiasts, we really want to get into like the nitty gritty and look at all this, you know, data we're handling and look at all the things we're doing with it. And it's like, okay, this is where email is coming from. This is how email can get here. And then also that visibility piece, I feel like you wouldn't necessarily see this problem specifically right away, but it would be good to just look at just email records coming in when you set up a solution like this to say, not only is it working, but where am I seeing emails coming from? How are they being handled or processed in general? Are there other things that I should be considering? Are there other things that are saying this is okay? And then you're like, why is it saying it's okay? You know, just like some of those preliminary checks, just to try to understand your technology or your deployments better from a data perspective can also be very telling of give you ideas for new things to try or ideas for things that you maybe want to add or remove. For optimization or security practices. But I really like this attack only because it was elegant in a way of the understanding of the infrastructure that existed for them to take advantage of.
Yeah, and considering the elegance of it too, because I think that's clearly the thing that stands out, right? Just the understanding and just the process was really smart. The smash and grab approach surprised me a little bit. It was one of the like first couple thoughts I had when I read this of the volume of the campaigns that they sent out. And, you know, law of averages, you send out so many, you're going to, you know, kind of get, you're going to get a bulk, but a technique like this could be, you know, as a colleague even mentioned it, one of our coworkers even mentioned it, you know, you could have been a little smarter, maybe went after more spear phishing approach, and who knows, maybe they did, but based on the volume and the numbers, it seemed more like kind of a smash and grab, right? But it's really interesting. And I remember back in, you know, early days of SOC work, when you're analyzing spoofed emails, you know, you see stuff that from all of your visibility points as an analyst look legitimately like they're from this company. Your next up is saying, hey, I think this company's hosed, right? Like, I think this could, you know, and then you get almost involved like with multiple people. Right. Yeah. And if it's a partner or if it's somebody you do business with, then you're engaged in this kind of collaboration thing. Hey, we have this evidence that you're hosed, and now you have all these people spun up working this process on both sides of the house. And thinking about this and all of those, that number of emails sent, I just can't help but imagine how many people are this year alone, we're literally in that space. You know, it's kind of wild to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it just kind of, I always feel like the numbers game always shows you a lot of times what kind of adversaries you're dealing with. Like, you know, I'm not an offensive person, right? And I feel like if one day I decided I want to be offensive, even though I'm smart when it comes to craft or understanding craft, I feel like if I found this one known vulnerability that worked really well, I'd probably lean into it heavy because I'd be super excited about, oh my God, this is going to detect it. I'm just going to smash and grab and use it as much as possible, right?
I kind of
feel like that giddiness is what this one was, right? Like someone was really smart. They figured this out. Like, oh my God, look what I could do. And then ran hard with it instead of being like, okay, we've got something here. How do we use this really effectively, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, and Gardio even mentioned inside of the article kind of maybe a poke at the methodology was they understood what this was because they clearly understood it to a level of sophistication that was good. So they probably had the assumption as well that this would, once found out, would be pretty quickly mitigated, if you will.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
so they were like, let's get as much out as possible right away.
Yeah, I mean, you can revoke some of the signing things right away. So that anything that's already out there obviously wouldn't work. Well, I guess you wouldn't really have to do that because they didn't really have the keys. So revoking wouldn't do anything. But yeah, just basically be on how you restructure some of the infrastructure pieces or whatever rules within the Proofpoint gateway. I mean, Proofpoint's a solid solution. And so I can understand why, you know, people offload a lot of their trust that way, right?
Well known.
But, you know, proof of work. The only dig I would have on Proofpoint at this point was because they're the leaders in this space, I feel like they should have had the, what are they called? Think tanks kind of thinking about this type of problem too, right? Hey, if we're going to be validating things, could we be used as the validator for malicious things because we have this kind of power? Like, how do we stop that so we're not the problem? You know, that's the only time I really hold vendors to that esteem where, if they're the leader in the market, I just expect them to be kind of on the bleeding edge. And so when I do fall off the bleeding edge or they get impacted by something kind of like this, you know, I mean, like another good example, right? Remember the recent issues with CrowdStrike and that whole update issue, right? Same thing. You know, we expect them to be the leading edge. There was an issue that occurred, you know, things happen, but it is kind of a knock on like, hey, you guys got to get your stuff together. You know, this stuff you guys, we expect you not to have these problems. And that might be unfair, but if you're going to be sitting at a company that's doing well and majority of the market, there is some accountability and responsibility there.
Yeah. And I think there is too, you know, just a kind of final thought on that idea is on the other side as well, right? Us as practitioners, us trying to leverage these tools, especially from a security mindset or, you know, anybody that's deploying them in their environment, you know, strong advice. And at least through my experience, and it's only limited to what I've gone through, is look under the hood. You know, when you kind of go through the sales point, when you go through the onboarding, when you go through all the processes of deploying a new tool set in your environment, don't stop at just the deployment package that the vendor gives you. You know, really get under the hood to look at things, ask questions, be curious.
My stance on that always is I hate when vendors or things out there in the market refer to themselves as solutions, because I think that terminology is such a fallacy. They're all tools, and how you implement those tools in your environment is the solution. So you as the person is the one creating the solution, and you decide what tools to use. Just like if you're a carpenter and you only have a subset of tools to build whatever it is you're going to build, how you use those tools is entirely up to you. And there might be better or worse ways to use those, but don't just buy this one tool and think it's your solution that's going to build the table for you. Right. And I think that's how people need to look at technology.
Yeah. And there's that plausible deniability from the vendor too, right? You know, their information is generally and usually there. Just out of the box, you may run into some gotchas, right? Like, you know, we've crossed paths before, and I'm betting you can harken back to this memory of like deploying a remote a cloud server where it just by default opens itself up to the world. And, you know, the general group that might be deploying something from that realm isn't considering that. They're not thinking about that. There's no real deployment process involved there. It's click a button and now you have a server that's wide open. You stage critical things there and you're not considering that, you know, but you can fix that. It's there. It's just not in the right in front of the user, right?
I think the one thing that vendors could do to protect themselves from the how their technology is used is they need to have really, really good documentation and knowledge base stuff, right? I know, because then I can, I feel like if you could sit there and say, we have all this stuff laid out, we have guides, we have everything. If you took the time, it says it in 20 different places to do it this way and you didn't. I think that's the protection. And I would love for that to be the validation of that, because too many times have I worked with solutions where the documentation is not good enough. You know, maybe the first version of it is, but then there's, you know, so many versions down the road, they haven't updated things, right? And I think it would be a great way to hold, it'd be great to hold, you know, fire to the feet of both, right? Hey, you're not reading the documentation. Hey, you're not publishing enough, right? So, yeah. All right. Off that soapbox.
It's a good soapbox.
No. This obviously, we have some strong feelings there together. So that's good. The next thing I want to talk about, I thought was kind of interesting. I'm probably going to butcher how this company or vendor is Eason Tire. Is that how you'd say it?
Yeah, that's how I'd say it. Eason Tire. Okay. Yep.
All right. Well, it's called Introducing Ghost Gambit, a dropper for deploying a ghost rat. Ghost rat, just like in most rats, it's an ability to have that remote access to a host to do a number of things. And a lot of times it's usually deploying spyware or ransomware at this point in the game. But this one, there's just some common things that I still see that always interest me. One thing that the Ghost Gambit does is it does create a batch file and run through a series of things. Not that big of a deal. We see that a lot, especially with some of the InfoSealer deployments. But there is the ping, the loopback address, which I think it's interesting because that's just a sleep technique that has been utilized so much. And it's something that we've had hunt packs for that since I originally was building hunt packs just for looking for this behavior. And it's still a persistent behavior. So that was something that stood out immediately that I thought was interesting in the techniques they use. The other thing that the Gambit dropper did that I thought was a little different was it actually created a logical drive in the registry. So in the registry in the local machine hive and the system, your control set, there's a session manager DOS devices. So it actually registers a path to the DOS devices to map basically physical or logical drive paths. And it creates an empty file in a directory called startup on this logical drive where it stages some of those things. And they think that's just because maybe it becomes a more of a trusted place when it comes to either users or security software. That was interesting. I haven't actually seen that registry key ever used before. I like that. There's also the adding of exclusions to Windows Defender. I thought it was interesting that it created a separate Windows Defender with the two R's path, and that's where it would, you know, put things and added. That was the actual exclusion for Windows Defender itself. But that's, you know, kind of run of the mill technique that's being used. And then after, you know, all said and done, it is modifying the current version run keys, right, for persistence, which, you know, another common thing. So between the ping, the current version run, and then the exclusions for Windows Defender, three behaviors that if you look for continuously or proactively, I should say, you will find a number of those kind of like lower level get in, but can be very disruptive type malwares or, you know, usually driven from a lot of social engineering and phishing, as great techniques to look for. The other thing that is noticeable or notable, when they talk about the actual rat and the list is below, like the list of commands you can do below in the table, usually the capabilities listed to different malwares are kind of interesting, but I don't really do much with them because I don't know exactly how they're run. And in this case, they actually had some good details that I liked, where, for instance, they said you can remove database files from Mozilla Firefox, and they show the command that's actually executed from the command line, with the delete, argument /s/f, and then the path to the database for the Mozilla stuff. Or they talk about enabling and disabling remote desktop, and then also changing the ports. So you can kind of get a feel for, like, hey, if you were going to enable or disable and change the ports, where would you see some of this activity? A lot of that's stored in registry. So just doing that activity and looking for changes on the system, you probably could build packages or hunts around these types of behaviors that are listed in this table. So that part I kind of liked. Now, there's enough detail here to get an idea for that. So really a lot of the things that I usually find in these circumstances are usually around the persistence or execution, which we kind of talked about before. And then there's some nuances once the rats and stuff is already on endpoint. But I really just want to call out that, they talk about this new gambit, right? This new way to drop in the ghost rat, which ghost rat's been around for a while. And you look at these new droppers utilizing really, really, really old techniques that obviously still work because they're not techniques that are supposed to just break and be stopped because they're practical executions. It's just that behavior, the way they're used, is very obvious. So tried and true, that's why we threat hunt, is just because of those reasons alone. But what were some of the things that stood out to you when it come to some of the details here?
Yeah, I mean, some piggyback items. I like that the article provided the table of kind of all the things the rat does. My mind went immediately to, like, how can I hunt with this? What kind of detections could I build? Like, there's a lot of it's basically bullet points of how to do that.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really good. But, a few notes that I have, the first thing was this campaign, the discussion around drive-by downloads. This is something that is constantly a thing. And this ultimately comes down to kind of that user education, but it made me think right away of, like, user base is going to user base. Users are going to user, right? So yeah. You have somebody in this one where somebody's going out to the web, either via some pop-up, something that's on a website that's driving them there. We're just raw searching because Google set updates. So they go to Google and they look for Google update, and there's some maybe SEO poisoning or some kind of a link that's brought up to the ads level or something. And then the user just clicks and downloads. Like, that first thought to me is, like, users going out to download their own Chrome updates. That's never a good thing, So that was funny to think about. It just harkened back to a lot of headaches that I've experienced myself. And I know you have too, Scott. But the one part that I did, I did want to kind of go in a little bit more, and you touched on it. The technique to leverage an unusual logical drive, right? Like building that partition or deploying that logical drive, I thought was very interesting. I've only come across this a couple times in different points. Where I might have considered building detections for this. And I remember that it's not super, because the first thought is, like, okay, well, let's see, anytime somebody deploys a new drive, especially in a relatively controlled environment, that should be pretty anomalous, right? That should be pretty rare by and large.
Yeah.
And you don't really, might not necessarily think about that. And I remember going back, and I had to actually circle through notes and then get in there and dig again, because I forgot a lot of this, because it's not incredibly intuitive on how to do that. But there are a couple things that you can do from a defense side to look for these things. Windows system event 98, event ID 98, where you have the source of NTFS, the Windows system event 58. I believe those are only on servers. I don't remember for sure. Did not 100% confirm, but where you have the source as the PART MGR, so partition manager. These events will help you identify when a partition is created. Also, there is a log source in Windows for those that aren't aware and might not be more heavier in the digital forensic side. There's a Windows partition diagnostic event log. I'm going to speak from a little bit of ignorance here. I don't know if the audit policy for that is generated by default. That's not something I looked up before we got on today. Should have. I'll take a few hits on that one. But event log 1006 will also give you partition creation events in that event log's location. So Windows partition diagnostic event logs. So I thought those were things worth noting for any that are listening. They could take that away and maybe look at the potential content in their environment for this. But yeah, that's all I got, Scott.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, it's one of the ones I always like looking at the latest malware-related things and seeing some of the oldest techniques. It just makes me feel good. So that's why this one stood out.
Tried and true and trusted, right?
Right. So what do you got for us next?
So the second article I have is from Checkpoint Research. It's titled Malware Distribution, Stargazer's Ghost Network. So I'm going to touch on some of the key points they had first because I thought, you know, I think they're relative to summarize this up. So excuse me for reading from it, but they're going to speak to it a little better than my language might. So Checkpoint identified a network of GitHub accounts tagged the Stargazer's Ghost Network, and it distributes malware and malicious links via phishing repositories. The network consists of multiple accounts that distribute malicious links and malware and perform other actions such as starring, forking, subscribing to malicious repositories to make them appear legitimate. The network is highly sophisticated and acts as a distribution as a service, so DAAS. It allows threat actors to share malicious links or malware for distribution through highly victim-oriented phishing repositories. The network has been seen distributing all sorts of malware families. Some of the high-level ones to point out: Atlantida Stealer, Radamanthus, Rise Pro, Luma Stealer, and Redline, just for a couple. Checkpoint's calculated that more than 3,000 active ghost accounts are part of this network. And based on the core GitHub ghost accounts, they believe the network began development or testing on a smaller scale for the first time back in August of 2022. So this has kind of been out there for quite a while. They did discover that an advertiser in dark web forums that was that provided the GitHub operation, the first advertisement for that was in July of 2023. And based on their records and monitoring mid-May to mid-June of 2024, it appeared that the actor tagged Stargazer Goblin earned approximately $8,000, but they said that this is likely a very small fraction, and the total amount during the operation's lifespan is estimated to be approximately $100,000. So while not overwhelmingly big ticket from dollar points, the type of campaign and the type of infrastructure here I thought was really interesting. So basically, and I might butcher this, Scott, you can clean me up a little bit here if you'd like, but the actor used Git accounts to do different jobs. So it basically allowed different accounts to do different jobs, giving more capability for levels of automation for this framework and fast pivoting if something were to be like taking down. So say one of the Git accounts that was hosting malware got flagged, they could easily spin up another one, leverage the other 1,000+ accounts to pull up its legitimacy, do some starring, do some forking, do some liking of the repository. But basically they did it in a wave of three. So they'd have like three different accounts doing something. So one account would serve up the phishing template in a README file. A second account would provide the image used for the phishing template. And then a third account would serve as the malware, the malware repository, and it would deploy the malware in a password protected archive, which would help it ignore Git's security kind of scans. So it would allow it to kind of pass through that. And I mentioned it already a couple times, but the additional network accounts they used heavily for legitimacy, and they would roll and they would spin and they would pivot them, and leveraging that approach for, you know, really quick spin up or use other accounts for responsibility shifts to keep it going if something were to come down. So I found this really interesting. It's not overwhelmingly huge, but I think the layout, because most of the listeners are probably familiar with bad stuff being posted on various GitHub repositories or GitHub being used as a launch pad for a lot of malicious things. But this one seemed very complex. So what do you think, Scott?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. this has kind of brought me back to, you know, one of the strong points for some security tooling is like reputation checks, right? Like they do reputation checks. Like for instance, if you open a file that's a unique file to something maybe you're trying to do, like an executable or something, on your computer at home and you're running Windows, it'll tell you like, this isn't a well-known file. Like we haven't seen this, because Windows itself is collecting that telemetry to say, hey, we've had 100,000 users open this file. Nothing malicious has come from it. So it just inherently becomes more trusted based on reputation of how well known it is. And similar to, you know, website categorization, like we've dealt with this, one of the best ways for us to identify phishing domains wasn't based on so much when the domain was stood up, but did it even have a reputation to begin with? So if there was no category reputation at all, we just basically blocked it or alerted on it, which was a very strong indication. So reputation goes a long way in the security world, right? You know, almost, and you think about public key infrastructure, PKI. I mean, that is technically reputation based. Like we are trusting these CAs that say, hey, we're only assigning things that meet this level of validation or verification, and so they're therefore now you can trust them. I mean, trust is a built into security in many aspects, and reputation is a strong facet of that. This is an example of where they're kind of trying to exploit that whole trusted framework, right? Where they're using GitHub and the ability to like promote things. To me, like if you even look at like information disinformation campaigns, there's user networks that build trusts in the information someone might be sharing on social networks, or people pay for followers because people seem to think that the more followers someone has, like that whole, it's just weird. But this is an example, right, where you have these GitHub accounts that are going to host malicious things. In order to get that validation, they created this network of ways to promote these places in GitHub. And what's also cool when it comes to the whole GitHub approach is the resiliency that GitHub kind of is. I mean, that's what it was kind of made right. for, right? So now if it's like, hey, if we have ways to build and promote reputation, but we might get turned and burned, if we already have forks of whatever's malicious somewhere else, that's great. We just start promoting something else and it just looks different. And you know, so unless you're really following those breadcrumbs in this network, you can see how effective that can really be. And it's just interesting to see the other side of it, right? Like we know how we use reputation from security perspective on how do we defend against this? How do we identify net new things that we might care about? And this is like the attacker side. Well, how do we get around that? Like, what are some interesting ways that we don't have to worry about those types of controls? And we can get back to now they actually have to detect the code that's bad, not so much the approach. So yeah, I thought that was just kind of cool, like seeing the underside or the belly of kind of the offensive approach to these problems. And I just, you know, it's just funny because I do think, you know, the use of GitHub, it's so user-friendly, and it doesn't surprise me for it to be used like this. But what's scary is it's also pretty well-known, right? So I think it's easy for people to, once they start stumbling across this, seeing this, they can identify the problems and probably fix them. It's the other types of content delivery or storage or management or whatever stuff that's out there that maybe isn't as well-known. Like Discord was a great example of it when Discord was used to distribute malware, right? Before yep. people really got super savvy with Discord. Like, I mean, Discord was starting to get popular enough where Discord ninjas that could do some pretty crazy things. Like, yeah, I mean, APTs, you know, from nation states were using Discord to distribute malware, right? In a really effective manner. So I think it's really interesting when you see the redirection of people using other people's infrastructures and tooling to manage that is always really fascinating. And like I said, the ones that are the least known are the ones that worry me the most because they're going to take longer to get discovered. But yeah, like I said, it's just fascinating to see how people leverage these types of things and how they get around some of the reputation and defensive approaches that we have.
Very creative, right? Very creative. The Discord thing was one of the first ones I thought about. And, you know, before we move on to the next one, you should absolutely take Disco Ninja. You should go ahead and put your name on that one and just let's pump that one up a little bit. I like that.
I need like an emoji, really. If we can just get like, if someone can help me create a Disco Ninja emoji that I can start using, I would totally adopt it.
Love
this Disco Ninja things. Yeah. So, the next one is really, another thought piece. And, you know, I there's just so many articles as I was looking at things that just stood out as like, oh God, this almost brings an annoyance or a pain point or whatever. This one, it's HelpNet Security. So they always put out some really good, like pull from reports, statistics or whatever. And they really do kind of hit topics that sometimes irk me. So I kind of either align or disline, but they make me, they fuel me. And this one's talking about most CISOs feel unprepared for new compliance regulations. And where do I begin? So I'm not going to get into like the article basically says, you know, they feel unprepared and they have some examples of why, you know, where they need MFA, don't need MFA when it comes to accounts, a weak password, how they manage this, whatever. So my whole thoughts on compliance, and I never really agree with everybody on compliance, but I feel like if you do best practice in security of how security is supposed to be done, now granted, you might be spending you're not like going through the approach for how can I save money, right? So this is where you run into that problem where if you just did best practice across the board in security, you probably hit 98% of compliance requirements, right? And so that's where I have a problem with people like, oh, being compliant is so hard. I mean, sure. But if you're a shop where you don't have the budget and you're not big enough of a company to have the budget to do best practice everywhere, then you start looking, well, what do we have to do, right? But then you're already accepting more risk than you may want to and you don't realize it. So you got that whole problem. But the part that I do agree with that this article touched on is when they talk about defining an incident and reporting of incidents and what we share, what we have to share, all that part of it. That part, it's tough because there is no value in flooding a system of information of irrelevant data, right? You know, it's for a long time in security, and we've talked about this before, we've had this approach where let's just collect everything and we'll solve it later. We can't go into that approach when it comes to reporting and compliance-based things, because once, you know, it's compliance-regulated where you have to report literally everything, then it's going to be required for you have to review everything, and then how are you going to have the resources to do that, and what value are you going to extract from that? And if you're not extracting a good percentage of value from that, you're actually hurting operations than helping, in my opinion. But like defining what is a shareable event or what is whatever. And I hate that we have to get so specific on this, but like hands down, if something is an IOC and it's related to a real security event, it should just be shared. I don't see why not. IOCs get turned so fast. If an adversary learns that, oh my gosh, they have my IOC, great, we force them to change some IOCs. We may lose some visibility in what they're doing potentially, right? But hopefully we know more about the attack than just IOCs. And that's what's upsetting is if all we're learning from attacks are IOCs, we're not doing a good job as defenders. We should know more about what's going on around the IOCs to help us out with that. But the IOCs are really going to tell you, you know, point in time attack anyways. So sharing those fast just helps you understand what's the scale or scope of the actual attack or campaign or whatever it is. And then, you know, sharing where there's impact of an incident. Well, yeah, if there is clear malware running on a system or there is unauthorized access to a system, I think those are incidents that are worth sharing. Like we don't know, we wouldn't call it like a full on breach or like what the impact, like you don't have to share what the impact is. Just be like, yeah, we had malware installed and it looked like someone had, you know, hands on keyboard access. Or the malware was a crypto miner, so someone was able to, you know, get something, you know, executed or run, whatever. I think those things are fine with sharing. I think what we have to do is have good templates for what that looks like, because there one thing with dealing with data and sharing if things aren't standardized, what are you going to do with it? If everyone writes differently, that is a problem. I don't want to just dump a language model on to try to solve. I'd rather say, hey, there's these five types of things or whatever number of things we can define and create templates for. Just plug and play what goes in what fields or what whatever. And then we have a general idea of what data can start looking like. And if we need more information, tweak from there. I think that's the problem, is we have all these requirements that they're trying to push out sometimes with not actual solutions. And I'm using solution now instead of tool, because that's what they need to be at that point before we really start sharing those ecosystems. When it comes to compliance related things or regulatory related things, I think that's kind of an important approach at how to tackle those problems. So yeah, in this article, I kind of feel both ways. I feel like compliance, I want to put air quotes in the air, no one can see, is technically easy because the technical problem isn't there. Because let's be honest, you only have to comply if it's technically feasible, right? So if you have solutions and they're like, oh, you have to have this. Well, they're not telling you have to use a certain technical solution. So if you're using a solution that can't do A, B, and C, only can do A and B, then you can document that you can't do C. It's just not technically feasible. And, you know, maybe if you just bought the solution, you have to justify, well, why did you go with that solution, knowing that these are the things you have to comply with? Sure, but the compliance comes in after the fact. That is what it is. But yeah, so that's kind of why I brought up this article, because I usually don't side on the, oh my gosh, compliance is so hard, what are we going to do side. But I do feel for the, what are the requirements when it comes to information sharing and incidents and breaches and things like that. Because I do think things do need to be shared, but I think we need to do a better job on, because a lot of the questions these CISOs had in some of this article is, well, how would you define this? Like, what are the examples of? And a lot of times compliance requirements tries to keep it generalized enough so that you have some liberty to do that. For the fear of, hey, if they make things too specific, then now less people can comply. But yeah, so just kind of a burning piece. So just kind of curious what your thoughts were when you kind of threw this one your way.
Yeah, this one, I almost thought you were trolling me on, to be honest. When you started explaining this, I could hear in your voice the call back to some nerves being struck for certain things. And, you know, I can share some similarities there. So, you know, I agree a lot with what you said. You know, my thoughts really kind of go to, there's arguments on both sides. There's been a lot of discussion, at least apparently to me, about what a CISO is and what kind of background a CISO should have. Should they be more managerial, more technical, yeah, back and forth? And that was one part that, you know, that I'm going to kind of, I might stitch to as I continue to speak here, that always sticks in mind, because it is such a touchy subject. And the way a lot of businesses work, and you get your C-level people, they're generally, they have parallels of how they operate. Whereas in my personal opinion, I don't think a CISO can operate like that. They have to operate in a very different mindset. But the talk about the complexities and the overwhelming piece, I think there's a lot of truth to that still. While I do 100% agree with you, you know, taking security best practices out of the gate will cover the majority of what your regulation or compliance measure is going to be, right? But I think most places that works when you consider that from the start, right?
Right.
But I think most places are already so embedded in their process, it's so hard for them to go backwards to that mindset, right? So then they run into this strain. And then I think a lot of people from a compliance standpoint may shoot themselves in the foot because of their interpretation of what they need to do to meet the measure.
Oh,
right?
Man, you just struck a chord with me. Go on.
I mean, it's hard not to talk about that, right? Like how many places go above and beyond, a painstaking, so fearful of fines that they just want to cover everything. And then you create this massively complex compliance program or compliance measure for a given thing that just has no real base in reality to meet an audit. It just can't. There's just, you're opening yourself, you're adding
points of failure, right?
More points of failure to yourself, right?
Yeah.
And we've seen it, me and you've both seen it time and time again in different places. That's that, you know, that was one of the things that brought up. I think the other side too, you know, the reporting to whatever the compliance measure or the regulatory measure, reporting the incidents as they happen. I had experience through one, and I'll stay vague on the example, where a new regulation came out where there was a requirement to report all these things, right? So the basic piece came out where it said, okay, we want all of this stuff, right? So think a governing body saying, anytime that you have a phishing attempt on your environment, yeah, we have to know about it. And it's like, okay, that's insanity, especially depending on the size of the company. It could be massive.
Oh, like, how do you define spam versus phishing? Do you want it all?
Correct.
You want, yeah.
And by the nature of having, being a business and having email, you're going to get phishing attempts, and a lot of your controls take care of that. So why would I ever have to report all those? But you go through this process, and then it becomes this painstaking kind of back and forth. But if your regulatory body and the bodies underneath that they're trying to regulate or govern or hold these compliance measurements to, if there's communication and deploying that, if there's a collaborative effort and saying, okay, this makes sense and this makes sense, and they work together, so some regulatory person, analyst, or compliance analyst on one side is writing up all these things that they think are good, and then they get into the nitty-gritty on the ground floor with the entity or the environment that they might be trying to govern and say, okay, well, that's not actually feasible. Let's rewrite that to make it make sense. If there's collaboration there, it's going to take a lot of heat off of the CISO. It's going to take a lot of heat off each individual body having to meet that compliance or regulation measure. And if we see more of that, or, you know, maybe even if the CISOs were to try to leverage those conversations or push for those conversations, it might take a lot of weight off their back, you know? Mm-hmm.
No, it's interesting when you mentioned like the phishing email example. You know, it would be great, and I'm pretty sure you could probably do it in most of like the email gateways and controls systems that are out there, where if you just said, hey, if an email was blocked, forwarded to this email address, and whoever wants to collect all the information, if you could just set that rule up for a day, and everybody just has to be managed by the red, they would see very quickly, now what am I supposed to do with this? Like, some of these aren't even legitimate. Like, yeah, we don't have time to look to see if it's legitimate bad phishing or if it's just spam or just whatever, but these are all getting blocked for a reason,
mm-hmm,
of some sort, right? Because I mean, we need to talk from a reality, from a data perspective, and not only that, like, what is, you know, I've always, when it came to information sharing, you know, we all leverage different technologies, so part of me was like, yeah, it'd be good to share what's blocking what you block naturally, because if someone uses a different solution, they may not be blocking it. And then you'd have visibility that way. But how do you go about carving that up or sharing that practically? I don't think there's a great answer for that unless you have a lot of data infrastructure to help with some of those things potentially. Because out of the gate, I don't think it's just an easy solution like some people think, but yeah, I mean, like, let's be honest, we've been in part of those information sharing groups in general, and like what people are willing to talk about, it's always interesting, because what's important to someone, even from security practitioner's perspective, right, they're like, yeah, we saw this is really whatever, and we might be sitting back saying, that's not really that important to us, like, I'm not concerned about that. I know about that. I've seen this before. We actually have protections in place already. So immediately, even you can see from people that actually do this on a day to day, they'll find different things of interest.
Right.
So trying to standardize that might be kind of hard too, from a value add perspective. I think there's a solution out there. I just think being as brazen as you need to do these things because we don't know what to do to solve this problem is never a good approach.
Never. No, and it has to be collaborative. And too many people on different sides of the house, they're focused on one thing or another. So
I think it's okay to try and fail. I think that's the other problem, is people feel like we only have one shot at this and it's got to be perfect. And so they almost over design it, and then it doesn't go anywhere. I think that's one thing about the security community. When you have a lot of smart people in the room, how many times are they just like throw some really interesting ideas and like, well, that didn't work, you know, like, and then move on and improve, right? Like, some of my favorite open source solutions are the ones that just live forever. And if you go through like the issue logs and things that have been, you know, I mean, you're talking like pages upon pages, millions of issues that they've fixed over time, and the solution is great today. But you imagine if all these issues existed back when they originated, it would be a crap solution. I feel like that's how maybe solutions should exist in this space, that like compliance, other things, where like, let's have what we think is a good solution that's a little rough around the edges, and give our ability the flexibility and modularity to improve upon that.
Constantly evolve it, right?
Right, because we can't expect the environments we operate in to be static either, right? And technology will get better and attacks will change. Like, let's just figure out how to like naturally grow and make it with the least amount of hurdles to do so. Just focus more on that.
The worst part, Dodge, the thing that this might, sorry, I'm going to strike another nerve, maybe, it does for me. The worst part is having those such rigid kind of regulations and compliance frameworks in place that doing better security becomes harder, right? Like doing better, making better decisions, you're handcuffed to a compliance measure because you can't start trying to do a thing that's going to make your operation far more sophisticated. Those ones always bury me in fire for sure.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. So yeah, I thought it was a great talking piece. Because I don't think I think there's people that think about compliance, and there's people that think about security, and very seldom do I think we think about those things together appropriately. And so this article kind of made me, it was able to speak two sides of a coin where I felt completely different, right? Depending on what side of the coin I was on the talking points. So I thought it was a good thing to kind of bring up and kind of voice my opinions. And I knew you'd have some of your own too. But I think it's a good thought piece. Again, like I said, more thought pieces for me this time around. But I think definitely good problems to be aware of that hopefully as a community we can get better at solving.
100% agree, and thanks, Disco Ninja, for not making that a troll effort, because I really thought that was something to just troll me. So, good conversation.
Before we close out, I just want to make a couple quick mentions. We do have the workshop happening tomorrow, or Wednesday, the July 31st, which is 12 to 1 p.m., and it is Hunting for Command and Control with Lee Arcanol and Jorge Rodriguez. Should be a good time. I've already had people hitting me up. They're excited about it, so that's always good to see. And also, if you're going to be going to Black Hat this year, there'll be two booths, and you can find me at both. I'll be there. But check out booth 2813 and 4524. Say hello, have some conversations, check out what we're doing. Love to talk shop, love to show some things. So please stop by. With that, just want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast today. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top five threat hunting headlines for the week of July 29th, 2024. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.